You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
From Lake Superior to Lake Michigan, this is Wisconsin's Morning Conversation. Daybreak with Brian and Jamie.
Good morning. It's 8:06. This is Daybreak. I'm Brian Noonan. Jamie will be back with us on Monday. Today you got me and Parker and Frank and you at 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. It is the top of the hour, and that means as you begin your day, we're going to let you in on some you need to know.
It's a wake-up call in more ways than one. Time for some you need to know.
You know the old saying, that sucks for you? It does when you have receipts and you can prove that what people are saying may not be the truth. We've talked about U.S. Representative Derek Van Orden on this show before. Well, now he is denying that he voted for cuts to health care when he backed President Trump's one big beautiful bill last year, legislation that will affect access to Medicare and Medicaid for thousands of Wisconsinites. Now, he was doing an interview with WXOW in La Crosse, and Van Orden responded to protesters that were outside his town hall meeting in Sparta, who said they were disappointed by his vote for the bill last year, which includes cuts to Medicaid and Medicare. In the interview, DVO said that while protesters had the right to be there, he just wished, quote, they knew what they were talking about, end quote. He went on to say, there have been no cuts to Medicare and Medicaid. There's not going to be cuts to Medicare and Medicaid. What's going to end, though, is the rampant waste, fraud, and abuse present. Here's where the it sucks for you comes in, because these are the facts of what happened with the big, beautiful bill. Maybe he forgot. Now, it's been a year. My memory isn't what it used to be, so perhaps Derek Van Orden's memory is not what it used to be either. So I will refresh his and your memories. The facts. All of Wisconsin's Republican delegation in Congress supported Trump's bill. The bill included, listen to this part, tax cuts, increased spending on immigration enforcement and the military, and a nearly $1 trillion cut to Medicaid. What? A $1 trillion cut to Medicaid. Oh, Brian, I thought he said they didn't cut Medicaid. A $1 trillion cut to Medicaid. That's according to USA Today. Now, the cuts are expected to go into effect by 2027. So maybe that's what he meant. Maybe he was saying, you didn't get any, there's no cuts right now. Maybe it's all a matter of timing for DVO. We don't know. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that more than $900 billion in Medicaid spending cuts under the new bill over a decade. How much, Brian? $900 billion in Medicaid cuts. Oh, Republicans argue measures such as work requirements for able-bodied recipients are in place to ensure Medicaid isn't cut for those who need it. The CBO estimates more than $500 billion in Medicaid yearly automatic cuts over the decade. Now, the bill requires able-bodied adults to work 80 hours per month to qualify for Medicaid benefits. It freezes the provider tax in states like Wisconsin that have not expanded Medicaid, and it gradually lowers the provider tax rates in expansion states from 6% to 3.5%. If you're not sure, Medicaid is the primary health program for low-income people. It's jointly financed by states and the federal government and is known as Badger Care here in Wisconsin. So last year, shortly after the bill was signed into law, on July 4th, Wisconsin lawmakers rushed to sign a state budget into effect to avoid the freeze on the provider tax. The budget included a provision that expanded the state's tax on hospitals from 1.8% to 6%. But for Derek Van Orden to say that the protesters don't know what they're talking about, maybe you need to look in the mirror, sir. They seem to know what they were talking about, because the big, beautiful bill did indeed have cuts to Medicaid. All right, let's go from Republicans in Wisconsin to Republicans in the U.S. Senate. Senate Republicans yesterday again blocked Democratic legislation that would halt President Donald Trump's war with Iran, but the number of GOP senators voting against the war did grow. Listen to this. Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski, she of the flip-flop Mulirap, she loves to flip and flop. She voted against the war for the first time since it began at the end of February. Two other Republicans, Senators Susan Collins of Maine and Rand Paul of Kentucky, also voted against the war, as they have done in previous votes. The War Powers legislation ultimately failed to advance 49-50 with Parker. I'm going to give you a guess on this. Who was the one senator that the only Democrat who opposed it?
Was it John Fetterman?
It was indeed John Fetterman. Ding, 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 ding. Ooh. Again, the prize closet woefully empty, but someday it'll be filled and you'll get something. Yes, John Fetterman, the Democrat in name only, the dymo, as they, you know, the Republicans like to call people rhinos. I'll call him a dymo. He is a he voted to oppose it, yet the close tally reflected growing unease with Trump's war. Several other Republican senators have signaled they want Congress to weigh in on the direction of the conflict. There will be a day, and it might be soon, according to Democratic Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia, where this Senate will say to the president, stop this war. Even if it passes the Senate, a War Powers resolution would have a slim chance of passing in the House, because we all know that Mike Johnson is a yes man for the administration. Democrats say the votes are about building political pressure on the president either to withdraw from the conflict or seek congressional authorization to wage the war. He will never do it. Now we are in Operation Sledgehammer, if you are keeping track of the various operation names that change before or at the 60-day mark where the president would be required, well, by the Constitution and whatnot, which doesn't seem to mean much, but he would be required to then get congressional approval for the war. So the White House has asserted that it does not need congressional authorization for the war and has circumvented legal requirements. It claims it has terminated hostilities with Iran because the U.S. has entered a ceasefire. We've heard all that from the president and from Pete Hegseth, and it doesn't ring true to anybody, because even during the ceasefires, it's hard to be in a ceasefire when you are actually launching missiles at another country and another country is launching missiles at you. That posture has created tension between Republican-controlled Congress and the White House, because presidents under the War Powers Resolution are required to obtain authorization from Congress after 60 days, which we know. And we also know that if you start a new action, that bypasses that, and that is the loophole that I think we need to look at closing someday. Republican leadership has continued to back the war, arguing that the stalemate in the Strait of Hormuz that has blocked most commercial shipping ports puts more economic pressure on Iran than it does on the U.S. But let's all remember, and I don't think we've said this all week, Parker, but the Strait of Hormuz was open before this, and there was a nuclear deal in place before this. But the president did not like that deal because it was brokered by Barack Hussein Obama. And yes, and I said Hussein because I know that's how this administration refers to him. But so Barack Obama had this deal in place. The strait was open. Everything was going along. There were international inspectors going into Iran. Now, I don't trust Iran as far as I can throw them, but I also know that these international inspectors had no ties to anybody, and they were keeping Iran's nuclear program in check. For some reason, somebody whispered in Trump's ear that there was a bomb, imminent threat, and off to the races. All right, moving on, more stuff you need to know. A Nina Foundry is going to have to pay $200,000 to settle DOJ air control violations. Nina Foundry Company will pay $200,000 to settle claims that it violated air pollution control permits and state and federal regulations. The Wisconsin Department of Justice on May 6 filed a complaint against the foundry in Winnebago County Circuit Court that alleged 18 violations of its air control permits. The Wisconsin DNR regulations and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency regulations, all of those alleged to have been violated. So Nina Foundry's current owner, Charlotte Pipe and Foundry Company, in a statement to the Post Crescent, said that the investigations were related to record-keeping practices, oops, and permit interpretations prior to its ownership. Now, Charlotte Pipe's statement noted that matters the state investigated did not involve actual emissions violations or allegations of pollution. So the nearly $200,000 payment includes the fine, surcharges, and court costs. So even they have to pay fees, just like if they were buying something from Ticketmaster. The state alleged that 18 violations related to the foundry's failure to maintain and operate air pollution control devices and monitors, inadequate record keeping, and failures to report incidents to the DNR. So the Charlotte Pipe and Factory went on to say in their statement that investigations from 2019 and 2021 prior to the company's acquisition of Neenah Foundry in 2022. So since Charlotte Pipe's acquisition, it said there have been no substantive findings in any of the federal or state investigations. So we will follow this and see what comes of that. And if it is just record keeping and it was all before, well, then good on them for not polluting the air more than anybody else, I guess. Or at least staying within the guidelines if they do. All right, you know Jerome Powell has been on the hot seat for a long, long time as the Fed chair. Well, his term is coming to an end, and the Senate has confirmed his replacement. U.S. Senate confirmed Kevin Warsh as chair of the Federal Reserve, one of the most powerful roles in the federal government that holds enormous sway over the economy. Just hearing that sentence, do yourself a favor and wonder, who will Kevin Warsh be answering to? I wonder if he's a friend of the president. And I wonder if he will do with the rates what Jerome Powell has refused to do. Well, let's find out with a little more information, shall we, while you ponder that question. The 54-45 Senate vote on Wednesday was split along party lines with the exception of, Parker, one Democratic senator. Who do you think?
I'm going to go for the two-time John Fetterman.
You would win two times. Ooh. Yes. Wow. Dino the Dinosaur Senator John Fetterman from Pennsylvania, who joined the Republican Party in its vote. It was the most divisive confirmation vote for that position in the history of the Federal Reserve. Warsh was confirmed to a four-year term as chair and a 14-year appointment on the Fed's rate-setting board. Now, Warsh will officially step into the role today. Today is May 14th, and that is the term of Jerome Powell's. His term ends today, so Warsh is now the guy. He's taking over leadership of the Fed at a time when the central bank faces immense pressure from the Trump administration to lower rates, even as inflation climbs and war in the Middle East continues. But hey, that's all right. We know the Fed sets those interest rates. We know that Warsh has echoed Donald Trump's calls to lower rates, but he has to convince other members of the Fed's board to do so. He was, before Warsh, the most divisive Fed chair confirmation was in 2010 when Ben Bernanke was confirmed by a 70-30 vote. Warsh is an Ivy League economist, former Wall Street banker. He previously served as a Fed governor from 2006 to 2011. And during his time on the board, he was known as an inflation hawk, advocating for higher interest rates to combat high inflation. And now he's a Trump hawk, where he is going to push, it seems, for lowering the rates despite everything else that's going on. He interviewed for the top position at the Fed in 2018. Trump ultimately appointed Powell, a decision he now calls, quote, a really big mistake, which ironically is what a lot of voters are calling his election just a couple of years ago. Anyway, that's it for that. When we come back, in this divided time, have you ever had a civil, real-world political conversation with someone you disagree with? People are trying to get us to do that. Yes. What time is it? We still have a minute. I'm early this time, Parker. No, we don't. It's the Civic Media.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Now back to more of Daybreak with Brian and Jamie.
Good morning. Have you sat down recently and had a civil, real-world political conversation with someone you disagree with? 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. Julie texted in. She's listening in Wausau, and she went back to the flag conversation that we were having a little bit ago, where I mentioned that I like flying the American flag, but I don't like the fact that it's been co-opted by the MAGA movement as something to drape yourselves in false patriotism. And I don't want to also have to explain, you know, that that's not what I believe, that I can be proud of my country and still disagree with the majority of what's going on. And Julie texted in, I supported athletes that kneeled during the national anthem. Holding your country accountable to its ideals is patriotic, but MAGA turned it into something else. I fly the flag and put my Democratic signs underneath it, so there is no doubt where I stand. Julie, thank you for the text. Yeah, I was telling Parker I have a garden-sized flag out at the start of my driveway. So once you pull into my driveway, you see it's one of those in this house we believe in flags. You know, the All Lives Matter, Love is Love, We Believe in Science, that kind of thing. So if you see that and then my American flag, you probably should know where I stand. Plus, I have a giant, big rubber duck welcome flag that hangs in front of my house, too. So it's really not, there's not mixed messages. You pull it and you go, all right, well, here we are. But anyway, the reason I ask this is because I don't want to have to sit down, and I'm guilty of this. We used to not talk about politics. Remember a time, Parker, you're probably too young for this. Used to be politics and religion in polite society you didn't talk about. And then politics became all people talked about. And then religion started really pushing into politics. So it intertwined religion, politics, the whole thing. And for most of us, you know, even after Trump was elected the first time, I tried really hard to get inside the mind because I thought it was an aberration. I knew there were some issues. I was trying to figure out why people made that choice. And then there were some people who made that choice for legitimate reasons. But the farther that administration went on, and especially now in this second run, I can't understand it anymore. And to be honest, I'm also not arrogant enough to think that my opinion is going to sway someone. I can give you facts and give you my opinion and let you decide on yourself, but I'm never going to change somebody's mind. So I, like a lot of people, have gotten away from having political discussions with anybody that I know does not agree with me. And that's dangerous. I'm not saying it's the right way, and I'm not saying that's how we should do it. And that's how a couple people in Oshkosh are saying, this is not the way. So an Oshkosh resident named Nicholas DeGroot wants to inspire his neighbors to tackle the topic head on, the topic being polarization in politics and feelings being too tense and the cost being too high to actually have a conversation with people that you disagree with in a thoughtful and intelligent manner. When was the last time you did that? Be honest. Are you more like me who has gotten to a point where I'm not going to bother trying to talk to somebody about this because other than a few, you know, all right, we can both agree on that the immigration system needs to be fixed. Well, that's a jumping off point. But when you start having a conversation after that with people who are very strong supporters of this administration, how we get there varies widely. There's also a lot of parroting. And this happens on both sides, but more so after being gaslit for so many years, people tend to fall back on those gaslit talking points that they've been spoon-fed, like high-protein oatmeal or high-fiber oatmeal. They've had it jammed down their throat, so they don't. But anyway, the attitude or the antidote for all these arguments, Nicholas DeGroot says, is to bring conversation about shared issues back in the flesh in a public place. So they do these groups in the park. They set up a little table, they put some chairs out, and people come to the park, and it's been slow. He admits it's hard to get people to do that because we're all nervous about getting into confrontations. But he does this, Politics in the Park, it's called. So if you're in the Oshkosh area, go to the park and check that out. So these are kind of the questions that he asks to guide discussions, and maybe you can use some of these in your own life. If you would change one thing about your government, either local, state, or federal, what would it be? It's a pretty good nonpartisan question. What's one thing you'd like politicians to stop doing? What's something you think we could fix if we just talked about it more honestly? What gives you hope when it comes to politics in your community? What do you think people get wrong about folks who vote differently than them? which is a very good question. And we could start a whole conversation about that. Maybe we will. Maybe we'll throw that in. Frank, make a note. I've just had a programming meeting in my head. The best place to have programming meetings, because then I don't get any pushback. Now, later in real life, when we have show prep in the park, then then I'll hear from Frank that yeah, that idea was really dumb. I'll go, all right, well, let's talk about beavers some more. That'll be fun. Either way, we're going to have a good time. But this is... I don't know if we'll ever get back to it. I think having social media involved makes it even harder because people are so used to saying whatever they want without interruption. I can post an entire screed on social media and it can be as belligerent and belittling and angry and full of vitriol as anything but I would never say that to a person sitting across from me in the park. And that's the problem. We've gotten so used to hiding behind social media screens that we don't want to have these conversations. And we are all so tribal and set in our ways. And I'm not saying this is just Republicans. I admit it to it myself. So it's not just a you guys. It's a all of us kind of thing. And I know it sounds a little Pollyanna. Maybe I'm channeling Jamie because she's not here and I miss her and I want a little Pollyanna in the show to say, this is how we should do it. But Brian came back and said, yeah, but I think we're way past that point. Way past that point. After the news, when we come back, we're going to talk to two groups who are very opposed to the spending bill, so they must be happy today in Wisconsin. We'll do all of that after this on the Civic Media Network. My name is Brian Noonan, and this, my friends, is David.
Now back to more of Daybreak with Brian and Jamie.
Good morning. Welcome back. Brian Noonan on Daybreak, 855-75-CIVIC is how you get a hold of me. Jamie will be back on Monday. Well, last Monday, it was announced that Governor Evers and Republican leaders of the state assembly had reached an agreement on a spending package that would use $1.8 billion of the state's budget surplus, leaving about $700 million in the surplus and $2 billion on the rainy day fund. The money was supposed to be used to deliver hundreds of millions of dollars to schools, lower property taxes, eliminate taxes for tips and overtime, and send checks to each income tax filer in the state. Now, the plan met with strong opposition up until yesterday, not only from Democrats, but some from both sides of the aisle. After passing in the assembly yesterday, last night late, the bill failed to pass in the Senate. Two groups that had opposed the plan are Kids Forward and Survival Coalition of Wisconsin. To lay out their objections and their reactions to yesterday's defeat of the bill, I'm joined by William Park Sutherland, the Government Affairs Director for Kids Forward, and Tammy Jackson, co-chair of Survival Coalition of Wisconsin. Welcome to both of you. Glad you could be here in to recap what's been happening. But real quick, so that people understand why your groups were invested in this fight against this proposed package. Tell me a little bit about your organizations. We'll start with Tammy. What is Survival Coalition Wisconsin?
Well, Survival Coalition is actually a collection of many statewide disability and aging groups. And we have a lot of interests that span all sorts of supports that help people with disabilities, including special education, but also Medicaid and long-term care and lots of county-run programs and also employment programs. So we have a pretty broad group of people who are really paying attention to a lot of the things that help all of us across the state stay in our homes.
All right. And William, what is Kids Forward? What do you guys do?
Kids Forward is a statewide multiracial policy center that works on advocating for long-term solutions to problems and getting at the root of those problems and having long-term solutions that actually work for people in the areas of healthcare, childcare, immigration justice, youth justice, and fiscal policy, so kind of what we spend our money on and what that says about our values.
Well, then that falls right into this program, because both organizations put out statements when the governor and the leaders put this proposal out the other day. What were your, William, let's start with Kids Forward. What were the main objections to the proposal that you guys saw?
Yeah, so I think, you know, the biggest problem is that it relies on one-time money to paper over long-term challenges. for the short term, while kind of leaving those bigger issues and the responsibility for those bigger issues and the blame, frankly, for the next legislative session. You know, this would spend down our surplus rather rapidly. Again, that's one-time money. It would potentially cause a significant structural deficit, making it harder in the future for us to respond to, you know, the potential or likely economic challenges that are coming to us with lots of cuts in the federal government to programs that Wisconsinites rely on every day, like Medicaid and food share or SNAP. You know, that would potentially set us up for having to make some really tough choices down the line. And I think most importantly, if we want to be really clear about what affordability means for everyday families, we need long-term solutions, and we need to ask the wealthiest few to actually pay their fair share. And this bill cuts taxes, or would have cut taxes, would have sent some checks to some filers, but the people who probably need that relief the most would have gotten very little of it, and doesn't really address the actual costs of childcare, housing, groceries, healthcare affordability over time. We need to get real about affordability. We need to get real about taxing the people who can afford it, and actually raising revenue so that we have long-term money in the bank that we can actually decide how to spend to meet Wisconsinites' needs.
All right, Tammy, besides those objections that William voiced, were there specific ones that Survival Coalition looked at this proposal and went, well, that's not going to work for us?
Well, I think part of what we are concerned about is that there are so many things that are missing from the proposal that are current problems now that this current state and budget didn't address. And I think for a lot of disability and aging advocates, we've been watching over many years and seeing that the amount that the state budget has set aside, whether it be for education or Medicaid, is often not enough to cover actual costs. This year, we have a waiting list for Division of Vocational Rehabilitation Services for the first time since 2014, because the legislature did not set aside enough money to actually draw down the federal funding that supports that program. And by the end of the year, we're going to have 15,000 people with disabilities who want to work, who are going to be told, no, you have to wait for at least a year, because there's an example of a program that is partially supported by state funding that didn't get what it needed. And that is true across a lot of programs that are really, they don't necessarily have a lot of money in them. But when you think about people who need transportation, who are non-drivers, who are trying to access county programs and ADRCs, who are trying to access, say, the justice system. Over the years, we've heard from many, many core functions across the state that they have either not gotten the increases that they need or have, you know, come up with shortfalls. And we're concerned about that because it puts us in a structural position where the things that people need aren't adequately being funded now to operate like they should. And that makes reducing the amount of money the state uses to pay for those things, it doesn't make the problem better. And of course, our organizations have also been really following what is happening at the federal level and what is happening in other states. And we are seeing many other states, often states that have cut revenue and cut taxes in good times, now having really, really painful situations happening already before the cuts that happened last year are truly in effect in their state budgets. And we just see from our counterparts that this is the future for lots of states. So to put ourselves in the position where we are making that scenario more likely, that the things that are not funded enough now have even less funding or are subject to cuts in the next budget and in future budgets, I think it's just a really ill-timed time to do those things.
My guests are Tammy Jackson, co-chair of Survival Coalition. SurvivalCoalitionWI.org is the website, and William Park Sutherland, government affairs director for Kids Forward. If you go to kidsforward.org, you can read all about them as well. All right. Now, as we saw the breakdown, and so that you guys know where I stand, I'm 100% behind funding schools. I'm a former educator. I want these programs funded. I understand that. I also understand that, as the governor said, this was a compromise. My fear is, and I'm sure there are other people thinking this, if it was based on politics, this decision, because we saw Tom Tiffany also opposed to it. Well, we know he wants to be governor. He's going to do that. And I know, Tammy, that Survival Coalition said no deal is better than a bad deal. Hypothetically, what happens? Because these are issues that have not reared their head in Wisconsin just recently. This has been an ongoing fight. If Democrats lose the governor's office, and if the legislature doesn't flip, as many people hope it will, you're in a worse boat than you're in now. So I guess making a deal with the devil in the short term, is that not a gamble that you think is worth taking, seeing that November may not go as everybody hopes, and then it would seem, based on past track record, that the situation is going to be even more dire getting the funding that is needed for some of these programs, even though there have been promises to fund some of these programs before, and it never came through. William, we'll start with you.
You know, I mean, I think at the end of the day, we have to make decisions based on where we are. And, you know, some of these things sound helpful, but they won't actually help people who need it the most and might end up hurting low-wage workers. So an example is no tax on tips. That sounds like a good idea. Sounds like a good policy. People want to keep more of their money. What it will probably do is push employers to replace stable salary jobs and stable hourly rates with unstable tip-dependent work. That'll do very little to actually make work pay. And it will continue to allow employers to move things around. It could also potentially create a way for wealthy employers to pay some of their compensation in tips and kind of reclassify their wealth. You know, so there's a lot of these proposals that sound like they could be good, but at most, they're going to do very, very little, and they might actually make things worse in the long term.
So in the long term, what do you think will happen? If worst case scenario for the election in November, what do you guys both think will happen then? Because we've been running into roadblocks for a long time.
You know, I think that one of the things that's true is that the three main architects of this deal are not going to have to deal with the consequences whatsoever. And if Governor Tiffany and whoever the leaders are in the legislature are coming together and confronting these issues one way or another, they will have to address the consequences and they will have to live with them. You know, I think one of the big concerns here is that this is an opportunity for people to pass the responsibility to fix this onto the next legislature, the next government, without critical resources to do so. Spending near, you know, the biggest piece of this spending deal is one-time tax rebates that will do very little to address real affordability.
Tammy, we're back to square one. We got about a little over a minute left. Where do you see the most important next step being, especially for Survival Coalition and the programs that you guys have seen not funded as they were promised to be funded before?
Well, I think one thing is that we are always commenting on the policy and the things that we would say to whatever governor is in office and whatever legislature is, we are saying the same things in pretty much the same terms. Mm-hmm. So you're correct. The problems are not new, but I think this is a real opportunity to take a breath and have a different vision. And you need to have a broader conversation about this. A lot of the services that people with disabilities rely on require perpetual poverty forever. There are some fundamental flaws. There is a time to reimagine how we do these things. And special education is an example, and how we school, fund schools is an example of a place where consistently trying the same things over and over isn't working. And if you want to get to the outcome that we need, you have to do something different.
Well, hopefully we will. William Park Sutherland, Government Affairs Director for Kids Forward, kidsforward.org, and Tammy Jackson, co-chair of Survival Coalition, survivalcoalitionwi.org. Thank you both for being here. This is a much bigger conversation, and I know we will talk about it more down the road. Thanks very much. When we come back, there is a whole lot more, because it's Daybreak, and this is the Civic Media Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Now back to more of Daybreak with Brian and Jamie.
Yeah, just like war, we're in a three-point stance and ready to go. It's Daybreak. I'm Brian Noonan. This is the Civic Media Network. How do you feel about the fact that the Packers are not playing in Europe this year? No international game for the Pack. And do you even like those international games? 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. No international game for the Pack this year. 16 other teams are having these international games. The NFL ended its speculation about its record 9 international games during the 2026 season. Yesterday, they came out and said the international games will be played on 9 of the first 11 weeks of the season. The Packers were in the mix until the last possible minute. They were there, marked down as maybe an opponent for the Saints in Paris. We'll go to Paris. Watch the Packers under the lights. It will be fantastic. We will make love on the Seine, and it will be wonderful. Well, that went too far, but Paris,
I was talking about,
you know,
football.
It's very romantic. We are. Well, we're in a three-point stance and ready to go, Parker. So, anyway, the Saints are going to play the Steelers. Two of the Packers' three NFC North rivals, the Vikings and the Lions, also are going to play international games. The Packers last played an international game in 2024, facing the Eagles in Sao Paulo, Brazil. The Packers also played in London against the Giants in 2022. Parker, I know you have strong feelings about these international games.
I
was in London, not for the Packers game, but I was just ironically at the same point when the Raiders were coming in. I think they were playing the Seahawks one year.
Okay.
And so I was in the airport when all these Raiders fans got off the plane. And I was like, ooh, this is, you know, you don't want to be walking around London seeing everybody in their silver and black. Just like we imported a gang to London.
Yeah. The Raiders are one of the fan bases that will weird you out when you see them at first.
Yeah. Especially that guy with the shoulder pads and the face paint.
That's exactly what I'm talking about, Brian.
Tower of London. Relax. Nobody's coming to get you.
You don't need spikes on your shoulders. Just calm down.
Now, we know this is all about money.
We know the NFL is
trying to expand their markets, but you have strong feelings.
I hate the NFL doing international games. I don't like the international games.
Because you're America first?
Because I'm America first.
Okay.
I just don't, as a consumer of the sport, as an American consumer of the sport.
Oh, yeah.
I do not like them because it is just like a wrench in your Sunday. Like, I don't want to have to get up early for a Packer game because when they're in London, they start at like 8 o'clock a.m. our time. Yeah. It feels silly to me. I don't like that.
You can see their underpants.
And you can see their underpants. Yeah.
Yeah, when they play in London and France.
Yeah. Wow. All right. Wow. And I'm worried this year.
Sorry.
I'm worried this year about when they go down to Australia. They're going to be playing upside down, Brian.
That's true. Yeah. They'll be so thrown off in the bathroom with the toilets going the wrong way.
They will.
That it'll their mind will be on that.
Yes.
Or the fact that they had to hold it because they couldn't stand dealing with those toilets.
No.
And then that's not good.
It's not good.
Plus, it's a 24-hour flight.
It's a long flight. It's really hard for the players to go through that without a bye week being associated on either end of the trip. And I don't like needing to tie your bye week to something like that, which the Packers probably kind of will because they got stuck on a Wednesday game the day before Thanksgiving.
Right, against the,
the Rams they'll be playing on.
Oh, I thought they were.
No. Yeah, it's Rams this year.
I thought the Bears were the night before.
The Packers are the night before Thanksgiving this year.
Yeah, I thought they were playing the Bears.
No, they're playing the Rams out in L.A. At SoFi Stadium, as they say.
All right.
But I honestly, and you can probably hear more of this conversation on Saturday and Sunday this week if you listen to Make the Call on the Civic Media Radio Network, by the way.
Good job.
But I think that something to talk about with the Packers is the Packers really thought they were immune to doing international games.
Why? Because of the small fan base? That doesn't make sense. They're like the oldest one of the oldest franchises.
Because they travel so well. So the way that these games work is that you have to give up a home game, right? Like you're losing out on revenue from not only coming into your city, but coming into your stadium. The Packers travel well.
Don't you get a little something extra from the NFL or no?
I don't know how it works. I don't think that you would make nearly as much money as you would as actually hosting a home game. So the Packers thought they were immune because they traveled so well. And then they added the 17th game a couple years ago. Yep. And now the Packers are getting stuck going overseas, but not this year. And I'm very happy about it, Brian.
You're very happy that they're not going. The Bears are not going overseas either. I wouldn't mind going to see, like, there have been games we mentioned in London and there were games in Dublin. I wouldn't mind going to some of these. So the 49ers and the Rams are going to Melbourne. That's the one you were worried about. That is week one. And that is they did pick two West Coast teams for that. So the flight is a little shorter. If you had picked the Patriots and, you know, the Dolphins, that would have been a nightmare flight. At least it's a little closer flying from the West Coast. Then you got Ravens Cowboys in Rio de Janeiro, the Colts and the Commanders in London, Eagles and Jaguars also in London, Texans and Jacksonville also in London. Boy, I wonder what the next market's going to be for an expansion team.
God, they were talking about at one point, I don't know how serious the talks were, but I thought they were like joking about the Jaguars actually relocating to London for like half a year.
I remember that discussion. Yeah. It makes, you know, listen, it's Jacksonville.
They're exactly. Even, nobody's going who's to those gonna games. Miss them? Yeah.
Yeah. So then we've got some Paris, Madrid, Munich, and Mexico City. So those are the locales. I never, you know. Even when the Bears were doing one, I never got up early to watch it. I'm like,
I don't need that.
It's the weekend. Sunday's my day to sleep in, so I get to sleep till like 8. I
don't exactly.
I don't need to be getting up that early, doing all kind of craziness. Hey, guess what? Tomorrow's Friday. This is big. We're going to talk to Francesca Hung tomorrow. So if you are trying to figure out who you're going to vote for governor, Francesca will join us. We'll talk to her about her campaign and what she wants to do if she is elected governor. We will also have Dairyland Diaries, Swipe or Stay, and we'll be wrapping up the week because it's Friday, everybody. But I appreciate you being with us today and all week. We will talk to you again tomorrow. Don't forget to go to Spotify and subscribe to our podcast. Until tomorrow. I'm Brian Noonan, this is Daybreak, and you are listening to the Civic Media.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.